whatever preliminary rites of marriage or any other sacred ceremony connected with such things are proper to perform for those about to marry, now marrying, or already married, each person should ask the interpreters of sacred law, and following their guidance, consider that everything has been done properly for himself. As for the wedding feasts, one should invite no more than 5 friends of each sex, and likewise the same number again of relatives and household members on each side. The expense should not exceed what one's means allow. 1 mina for the man of the highest property class, half that for the next, and so on in proportion as the property classes descend. Everyone should praise the man who obeys this law, while the guardians of the laws should punish the one who disobeys as a man of poor taste and uneducated in the customs governing the muses of the wedding. Drinking oneself drunk is fitting nowhere, nor is it safe, save at the feasts of the god who bestowed wine upon us, and certainly not for anyone serious about marriage, an occasion on which both bride and groom above all need their wits about them, since they are undertaking no small change in life, and also so that the child conceived may come, as far as possible, from parents in full possession of their senses. For it's practically impossible to know which night or which day will beget it, with the god's help. Beyond this, procreation should not happen while the body is dissolved by drink, but the thing being formed should come together sound, steady, and calm in its proper measure. But the man overcome by wine is scattered every which way, and scatters others, raging in body and soul alike. So a drunken man sows in a distracted and corrupted state, likely to beget offspring of uneven character and uncertain body, crooked in neither straight body nor straight soul. That is why, throughout the whole year and indeed one's whole life, but especially during whatever time one is begetting children, a man must take care not to do, deliberately, anything conducive to sickness, nor anything bound up with arrogance or injustice, for this is necessarily stamped and imprinted on the souls and bodies of the children begotten, and reproduces itself, making everything worse in every way. Above all, one must abstain from such things on that particular day and night. For a beginning, once it takes root as a god among men, preserves everything, provided it receives the honor due to it from each person who has dealings with it. The man who marries should think of one of the 2 houses on his allotted land as a place for the hatching and raising of chicks, so to speak, and should make his marriage home and the raising of his children there, separated from his father and mother. In friendships, if there is some longing left in them, it binds and glues every disposition together, but constant, saturating togetherness, which leaves no room for longing to build up over time, makes people drift apart through sheer excess of closeness. For this reason, people should leave their own households, those of the wife's parents included, and go live as if arriving in a colony, watching over one another and being watched over in turn, bearing and raising children, handing life on like a torch from one generation to the next, and always serving the gods according to the laws. As for property, what kind of possessions would someone acquire to have the most fitting estate? Most of this is neither hard to think through nor hard to acquire, but the matter of household servants is difficult in every way. And the reason is that what we say about them is somehow both wrong and, in a certain way, right. For what we say about slaves runs contrary to our practical needs, and yet also follows from those very needs.
What do you mean by that? We don't yet follow what you're getting at, stranger.
And reasonably so, Megillus. Of nearly all the peoples of Greece, the helot system of the Lacedaemonians would cause the most dispute and disagreement, some saying it has turned out well, others not so well. Less contested would be the slavery of the Heracleots over the Mariandynians and the serf class of the Thessalians. Looking at all such cases, what should we do about acquiring household servants? This is exactly the point I happened to raise a moment ago in passing, and you rightly asked me what on earth I meant. We know, I think, that everyone would say slaves should be acquired who are as well disposed and as excellent as possible, for many slaves have already proven themselves better than brothers, better than sons in every virtue, and have saved their masters' property, and their entire households. This much we know is said about slaves.
Of course.
And isn't the opposite also said, that there is nothing sound in a slave's soul, and that a person of sense should never trust the class of slaves in anything at all? Our wisest poet declared this too, speaking on behalf of Zeus. Far-seeing Zeus takes away half the mind, he says, of men, whenever the day of slavery seizes them. Each side, holding to these different views, acts accordingly. Some trust the class of household slaves in nothing, and treating them like beasts, batter their servants' souls into slavishness with goads and whips, not three times over but many times. Others do exactly the opposite in every respect.
Of course. Well then, stranger, given that people disagree so sharply on this, what should we do about our own land, both about acquiring slaves and about disciplining them?
What indeed, Cleinias? It's clear that since the human animal is a difficult creature, and when it comes to drawing the necessary distinction in practice between slave, free man, and master, it shows itself thoroughly unwilling to be, or to become, something easy to deal with, the possession is a hard one. This has been shown in practice, time and again, in the frequent revolts among the Messenians, and in whatever troubles arise for cities that acquire many servants all speaking one language, and further in the deeds and sufferings of every sort caused by the so-called wandering bands of robbers around Italy. Looking at all this, one might well be at a loss over what to do about the whole business. Only two devices remain. First, that those likely to submit to slavery more easily should not be fellow countrymen of one another, but as discordant as possible in background. Second, that we raise them properly, not merely for their own sake, but even more out of regard for ourselves. The proper raising of such people means never treating servants with any kind of arrogance, and if possible, wronging them even less than one would wrong equals. For the man who reveres justice by nature, not by pretense, and genuinely hates injustice, shows himself clearly in his dealings with those people toward whom it is easy for him to act unjustly, namely, his slaves. So whoever proves himself, in his character and conduct toward slaves, free of impiety and injustice, would be best equipped to sow the seeds from which virtue grows. And the very same thing can rightly be said of any master, any tyrant, or anyone at all who wields power over someone weaker than himself. Slaves must certainly be punished as justice requires, and not be pampered by mere warnings as if they were free men that only spoils them. Nearly every address to a servant should be a command, plain and simple. One should never joke around with servants at all, neither with the women nor the men, which is exactly what many people foolishly do, spoiling their slaves, and thereby making life harder both for the slaves' obedience and for their own authority over them.
Rightly said.
Well then, once someone has equipped himself as best he can with servants sufficient in number and suited to assist with each kind of task, the next thing, in our account, is to sketch out the arrangement of houses.
Certainly.
And it seems that, speaking generally of the whole art of building, we must attend to the city that is new, and until now, unbuilt, how each part of it, its temples and its walls, is to be laid out. These matters, Cleinias, properly come before marriages, but since we are only doing this in speech, it's quite all right to take them up now. When it comes to actual practice, we will, God willing, arrange these things before the marriages, and only afterward bring the marriage laws themselves to completion, over and above all this. For now let's simply run through them briefly, in outline.
Certainly.
The temples, then, should be built all around the marketplace, and around the whole city in a circle, on the high ground, for the sake of easy defense and cleanliness. Near them should be the residences of the officials and the courts, where, as being the most sacred places, they will receive and render judgments, some concerning matters of piety, and in these same precincts should stand shrines to the relevant gods, along with courts in which the trials for homicide and other crimes deserving death would fittingly take place. As for walls, Megalus, I would side with Sparta in letting the walls lie sleeping in the ground and not raising them up, and for this reason, The poetic saying in their praise is a fine one, that walls ought to be of bronze and iron rather than of earth. But our practice would rightly earn us no end of ridicule besides, sending out the young men each year into the countryside, some to dig, some to cut trenches, and others to wall off passages with certain constructions, as if to keep the enemy from setting foot across the borders of the land, while at the same time we throw a wall around the city itself. Such a wall, first of all, does nothing at all to benefit the health of cities, and it tends besides to produce a certain softness of spirit in the people living within it, inviting them to take refuge behind it instead of repelling the enemy, and to think that safety comes not from keeping watch, night and day, with some of their number always on guard, but from barricading themselves behind walls and gates, and then falling asleep, believing they truly have devices for safety. As if born for a life without toil, unaware that ease, in truth, comes only out of toil. From shameful ease and laziness, I think, toils are born all over again. But if humans really must have some kind of wall, the private houses should be laid out from the very start in such a way that the whole city forms a single wall, with uniform, matching houses all facing onto the streets, all presenting a well-fortified front. It would not be unpleasant to look at either, with the whole city having the shape of one single house, and it would also be far superior for ease of guarding, contributing wholly and entirely to safety. As for keeping these buildings as they were originally constructed, that responsibility would fall chiefly on the residents themselves, but the city wardens should also see to it, compelling and fining anyone who neglects this, and they should likewise attend to cleanliness throughout the city as a whole, making sure no private citizen encroaches on any public property, whether by building or by digging. They must also see to the proper flow of rainwater and to whatever else it is fitting to manage, whether inside or outside the city. The guardians of the law, having surveyed all these needs together, should legislate further on them, and on anything else the law fails to cover for lack of foresight. Once these matters are settled, along with the buildings around the marketplace, around the gymnasia, and all the schoolhouses standing ready to receive their students, and the theaters awaiting their audiences, let us move on to what comes after the marriages, continuing our legislation in order.
Certainly.
Let the marriages, then, Cleinias, be taken as already accomplished. After this would come a period of living together before childbearing, lasting no less than a year, and how the bridegroom and bride ought to live during this time, in a city that is going to be different from most others, following on from what has just been said, is not the easiest thing to state. There have already been quite a few such difficult points, but this one is harder for the majority to accept than most of the others. Still, whatever seems right and true must be stated regardless, Cleinias.
Certainly.
Whoever intends to lay down laws for cities, prescribing how citizens should conduct their public and communal life, while thinking there's no need to legislate for private matters beyond the bare necessities, and instead leaves each person free to live his daily life however he pleases, without everything being brought under regulation, such a person, having abandoned private conduct to being unregulated by law. Imagines that citizens will nonetheless be willing to conduct their public and communal life by law, he is not thinking correctly. Why have I said this? Because I mean to say that our bridegrooms ought to take their meals in the common messes no differently and no less than they did in the time before their marriage. This practice, when it first arose among you in your part of the world, was a remarkable thing, brought about, in all likelihood, by some war, or by some other circumstance of similar force, among small populations gripped by great scarcity, and once they had tried the common messes and been compelled to use them, the practice seemed to make a great difference for their survival, and in some such way the institution of common messes became established among you.
So it seems. As I was saying, though this practice was once a remarkable and even fearsome thing to impose on people, it would not now be nearly as difficult for a lawgiver to legislate. But the next step, one that would rightly occur if it did occur, yet nowhere occurs today,
and which makes the lawgiver's task next to hopeless, a task like, as the saying about people who waste their efforts goes, carding wool into fire and countless other such futile endeavors is neither easy to state nor, once stated, easy to bring to completion. What is this thing, stranger, that you seem so reluctant even to begin telling us?
Listen then, so that we don't waste a great deal of time over this very point for nothing. Whatever in a city partakes of order and law produces every kind of good, whereas the many things that are disordered or badly ordered undo much of what has been well ordered elsewhere. This is exactly the point bearing on what we're discussing now. Among you, Clanias and Megalus, the common messes for men have been established well, and, as I said, remarkably so, by some divine necessity. But the corresponding practice for women has been left, quite wrongly, without any legislation, and the practice of common messes for them has never been brought into the light. But there is one part of our human race that has always grown more secretive and thievish than the rest, the female sex, because of its weakness, and the lawgiver did wrong to yield to this and let it run loose, untamed as it is. And because we let it go slack, a great many things have slipped past us that would be in far better shape now if they had received laws. For it is not merely a half of things, as one might suppose, that gets left in disorder where women are concerned. No, insofar as female nature is inferior to male in virtue, by just that much it is more than double the problem. So it would be better for the happiness of a city to take this matter up again, correct it, and arrange all pursuits in common for women and men alike. But as things now stand, the human race has come to this in so unlucky a state that no one of sound mind would even mention the subject in other regions and cities, places where common messes are not even accepted as a practice for the whole city at all. From what starting point, then, could anyone attempt in practice, without being laughed at, to force women to have their consumption of food and drink brought out into the open? There is nothing this sex would endure less easily. For being used to living a hidden, shadowed life, if dragged forcibly into the light, it will resist with everything it has, and will get the better of the lawgiver by far. Elsewhere, then, as I said, this sex would not even put up with the correct argument being spoken without shouting it down, but here, perhaps, it might. So if it seems worthwhile, for the sake of the argument, that our discussion of the whole Constitution not go astray, I am willing to say why it is good and fitting, if you two agree to hear it out. If not, I will let it go.
Why, stranger, we are altogether remarkably eager to hear it.
Let us hear it, then, and do not be surprised if I seem to you to be starting from some point far back. We have leisure to spare, and nothing presses us to avoid examining the laws from every possible angle.
Well said.
Let us go back, then, to what was said at the start. Every man should give real thought to this much at least, that the coming into being of humankind either has no beginning at all and will have no end, but always was and always will be, or else it has existed for a length of time from its beginning so vast as to be beyond reckoning.
Of course.
Well then, the founding and destruction of cities, all sorts of practices both orderly and disorderly, and every kind of craving for drink and food and eating, don't we suppose all these have occurred, all across the whole earth, along with every sort of turn of the seasons, in which living things are likely to have undergone countless changes of their own?
Of course.
Well then, do we believe that vines appeared at some point when they had not existed before, and likewise olives, and the gifts of Demeter and Cori, and that some Triptolemus served as minister of such things? And in the time when these did not yet exist, don't we suppose living things turned, as they do now, to eating one another?
Of course.
And indeed we still see, among many peoples even now, the practice of human beings sacrificing one another persisting to this day. Whereas we hear the opposite about others, a time when people did not even dare to taste beef, when the offerings to the gods were not living creatures, but cakes and fruits soaked in honey, and other such pure offerings, and people abstained from flesh as unholy food, holding it unholy likewise to defile the gods' altars with blood. Instead, what are called Orphic lives prevailed among those people of that time, keeping to everything lifeless, and on the other hand, abstaining from everything that had life.
What you have said is indeed widely told, and plausible to believe.
But someone might ask, to what end has all this just now been said to you?
You have grasped the question rightly, stranger.
And so, if I am able, Clanias, I will try to explain what follows from it.
Go on and speak.
I see that everything for human beings hangs on three needs and desires, through which, when they are guided rightly, virtue results, and when guided badly, the opposite. These are eating and drinking, right from birth, concerning which every living thing has an inborn passion, full of a frenzied craving and deaf to anyone telling it, it must do something other than satisfy the pleasures and desires bound up with these things, and must always free itself from every kind of pain that stands in the way. And a third need for us, the greatest and the sharpest craving, arriving last, but setting human beings most thoroughly ablaze with madness of every kind, is the one that burns with the greatest wanton excess concerning the begetting of offspring. These three sicknesses must be turned toward what is best rather than toward what is called most pleasant, and we must try to hold them in check by three of the greatest means, fear, law, and true reasoning, while also calling on the muses and the gods of contest to help quench their growth and inflow. Let us set the begetting of children after marriages, and after begetting, their nurture and education. And perhaps, as the argument proceeds in this way, each law of ours will be carried through to the point where we arrive at the common meals, whether such associations should exist for women alone, for men alone, or both, and by coming closer to the matter we will perhaps see it better, and settle in advance what still remains, even now, without any law governing it, and thereby, as I just said, we will observe these things more accurately and be better able to establish the laws proper and fitting to them.
Very rightly said.
Let us then keep in memory what has just been said, for we may well have need of all of it at some point.
What exactly do you bid us remember?
The things we distinguished by three terms, eating, we said, first, then drinking, second, and third, some frenzy over sexual matters.
We will certainly remember, stranger, what you are now bidding us to.
Good, let us turn, then, to matters of marriage, to instruct people how and in what manner they ought to produce children, and, if we fail to persuade them, to threaten them with certain laws.
How so?
The bride and groom must set their minds on producing for the city children as fine and as good as it is in their power to make. Now all human beings, in every joint undertaking, when they pay close attention both to themselves and to the task, accomplish everything nobly and well. But when they fail to pay attention or have no sense, the opposite happens. So let the groom keep his mind fixed on his bride and on producing children, and let the bride do likewise, and especially during that time when they do not yet have children born to them. Let there be overseers of this among the women we have chosen, however many or few seem right, whom the officials shall assign as they see fit, and whenever they see fit, gathering each day at the shrine of Eileithyia for up to a third of an hour. And once gathered there, let them report to one another whether they see any man or woman among those trying to have children paying attention to something other than what has been laid down concerning the sacrifices and rites performed at the wedding. Let the begetting and supervision of childbearing last 10 years, no longer, when there is a good flow of offspring. But if some remain childless through this period, let them separate, with the council of their household and of the ruling women together, deciding jointly what is fitting for each. And if some dispute arises about what is proper and fitting for each, let them select 10 from among the guardians of the law and hold to whatever those 10 determine and impose. Let the women enter the houses of the young, partly admonishing, partly threatening, to stop them from error and folly, and if they are unable to do so, let them go and lay the matter before the guardians of the law, who shall then restrain the offenders. And if even they are unable, let them make a public declaration, writing it down and swearing that they truly cannot make such and such a person better. And let the one so recorded be disenfranchised, unless he wins a suit in court against those who recorded him. In this respect, he shall not attend weddings nor the coming-of-age ceremonies of children, and if he does attend, whoever wishes may strike him with impunity. Let the same rules hold for a woman as well. She shall have no share in women's outings, honors, or attendance at weddings and children's birthday celebrations, if she is likewise recorded as disorderly and does not win her case. And once they have begotten children according to law, if anyone associates with another man's wife in such matters, or a wife with another man, while they are still of childbearing age, let the same penalties apply to them as were stated for those still begetting children. After that, let the man and woman who show self-control in such matters be held in good repute in every respect, and let the one who does the opposite be honored in the opposite way, or rather, held in dishonor. And where the majority behave with moderation in these matters, let it lie unlegislated, in silence. But where they behave disorderly, let what has been legislated in this connection be carried out according to the laws laid down at that time. The beginning of each person's whole life is his first year, and this should be recorded in the ancestral shrines as the beginning of life, for both boy and girl. Let there be inscribed on a whitewashed wall, in every phratry, the succession of officials counted by year, and let the living members of the phratry always be recorded nearby, while those departing from life are erased. Let the limit for marriage be, for a girl, from 16 to 20 years, the outer bound so fixed, for a young man from 30 to 35 years, for entry into public office, 40 years for a woman, 30 for a man, for military service, for a man from 20 up to 60 years, for a woman, whatever service in war matters seems needed of her, once she has borne children, let what is possible and fitting be assigned to each, up to 50 years.